Welcome to the 2010 Pilot Peer-to-Peer Dialogue. This educational activity is sponsored by the France Foundation and is supported by an educational grant from Intermune. CME information can be found at the website www.pilotforipf.org. Dialogue 3 is eligible for CME credit from November 2010 through November 30, 2011. Today, Drs. Padilla, San, and Strange will discuss the following. What are the important serologic markers, and when can they appear? Let's listen in.
Dr. Strange, what would you do with a patient who has known rheumatoid arthritis, interstitial lung disease, that on CT looks exactly like UIP, and is complaining of more shortness of breath and worse oxygenation problems? How would you manage that patient?
Unfortunately, we don't have any randomized treatment trials in rheumatoid interstitial lung disease. And this is a particularly hard problem because they have UIP, and to the extent they act like IPF, and we have no treatments to date for IPF that work, I end up managing a lot of these patients by looking at their joint disease and making sure that my disease-modifying therapies are appropriate for their joints, and making the supposition that if I can control systemic anti-inflammatory activity well enough, then I hope that my lung injury is going to follow behind. And the hard part about this is we see some dyssynchrony sometimes between the arthritic complaints and the progression of lung disease that makes many of us turn to TNF therapies early on, and whether we ever do that when joint disease is stable is a hard clinical question for us to sort out.
No, but you can make the patient feel better, even if you help with their joint disease. So there is a good rationale for following that kind of scheme, I think.
I think so too. You know, and often this takes combination therapy, and we take the lead from this from our rheumatologic colleagues. So I personally don't take hold of anti-inflammatory therapy in a rheumatoid patient without having a rheumatologist hand-in-hand follow me along, whereas I will in some of the other more idiopathic myositis cases. Occasionally the lung disease is so predominant that you're really in charge of the anti-inflammatory therapy.
Mm-hmm. In those patients in whom you do treat for the joints, and they do have associated interstitial lung disease, have you looked to see if indeed their pulmonary function gets better, or at least the rate of progression of these patients is less?
Yeah, the problem with FVC and our traditional measures in rheumatoid is they don't change very much. And think of all the work that we've done in IPF without having really great clinical outcomes in that disease. And my personal bias is that we are mirroring that in rheumatoid, whereas it's really these other connective tissue diseases that really set the stage for why we screen for this group of diseases, because many of the others are much more responsive than rheumatoid to our disease-modifying therapies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, others have stated that, you know, people with ILD, rheumatoid arthritis, actually have a better prognosis than the UIP patient. But then there's other people who say there is no difference in the survival.
Yeah, that's true.
I've followed a number of patients who seem to have very stable disease, rheumatoid disease, with a UIP pattern.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the experience of a lot of clinicians who do follow their rheumatoid arthritis patients and UIP patterns, that they remain relatively stable for a prolonged period of time until they get an infection that is associated sometime with the immunosuppression that we are giving them. But Charlie, talking about randomized trials, you know, we have to come back to the scleroderma trial, which you participated in, you know, quite well, as the only one that has now been, or one of the few, that has provided some guidance, some answers, and can you elaborate on that?
Sure. You know, scleroderma is a disease that we believe strongly should be screened with spirometry from the day of making the diagnosis onwards because of this high frequency of interstitial lung disease that we see. The scleroderma lung studies, you know, only got to do these prospective studies because they were NIH-sponsored, and it takes a lot of money to do these trials. The scleroderma one, as most of y'all know, randomized cyclophosphamide, a pretty toxic drug, to placebo. And interesting in that study was that both 12-month and 18-month FVCs were improved, but once cyclophosphamide was stopped at 12 months, the FVC then declined at 2 years back to its baseline. So cyclophosphamide improves lung function in scleroderma, but that improvement's not sustained, and what our real needs are to improve longitudinally, hopefully with a less toxic medicine over time. Mm-hmm. Scleroderma Lung 2 is now enrolling at a site near you, but is comparing mycophenolate mofetil to cyclophosphamide in a randomized design. And I think we've felt a little bit blessed to be able to continue this nice consortium that we have around the country in scleroderma clinical trials. And we really need these sorts of trials in all of these interstitial lung diseases associated with connective tissue disease. My feeling is every one of these connective tissue diseases is very different, and we probably wouldn't use cyclophosphamide for most of the other interstitial lung diseases that we see. You'd agree, Steve?
Yeah, absolutely. Too toxic a drug.
Yeah.
Isn't the Wegener's people now using follow-up therapy like the scleroderma therapy with very good long-term results?
Yes, so Wegener's is variably classified as one of our connective tissue diseases because it's a vasculitis, but they actually do have good randomized clinical trials in Wegener's now that would suggest that cyclophosphamide, if it's going to be used, should be kept a short course therapy, and once you get disease in remission, disease can be maintained on other less toxic agents over time. Mm-hmm. So I didn't mean to leave them out in my discussion of scleroderma being the unique disease that actually has trials in lung physiology.
An interesting point that arose in the study was that those patients who appeared to have benefited more were those who had progressive disease or whose function was declining more rapidly than others. And perhaps that allows you the opportunity to not institute this therapy on a scleroderma patient at the beginning, but to have the ability to follow them and see if indeed they warrant treatment with something as toxic as cyclophosphamide.
So cyclophosphamide has not only anti-inflammatory activity, it's a very strong drug to reduce neutrophils in the lung, but also slows down fibroblast proliferation. And we really don't know why that signal was strongest in the patients with the most progressive disease, but it may actually end up being an antifibrotic in its therapeutic approach here, which makes it more appropriate for the severe patient. What do y'all think about treatment of the myositis-associated diseases?
It's almost like the asthma of ILD, I would say, that you can die, meaning that you can get some improvement, you can get a benefit from instituting therapy. The question is, what do you institute? Do you institute corticosteroids? Do you institute corticosteroids plus immunosuppressive therapy? Do you do it sequentially? Do you do it simultaneously? I think that a number of these patients who have dermatomyositis or polymyositis, certainly corticosteroids have proven to be effective.
That would be the primary, Doug. And most of us will give a steroid-sparing agent, such as azathioprine, which is pretty well-tolerated. And I've had people who had recurrence and had a good response second time. And these people had basically an NSIP. Some of it could have been the fibrotic pattern, but they still got better.
Yes.
Significantly better.
They do.
There's one subset of the myositis spectrum of diseases that we probably shouldn't forget, though, and those are the individuals that present with ARDS. And they have a diffuse alveolar damage pattern that typically does not respond very well to steroids. Mm-hmm. And even though we give steroids and we can pull a few of those people out of the ICU, they're a unique subset that really don't respond very well in the clinic to an aggressive steroid regimen.
Yeah, those are the patients who often required sometime IVIG infusions or immunosuppressive therapy right off the bat. And they do have this acute presentation of ARDS with marked hypoxemia, febrile episode, and diffuse changes in their lung and their perhaps in that kind of ARDS setting, everyone should get an anti-JO1 and an anti-synthetase pattern, because you may pick up the 10 or 15% of those acute ARDSs that are due to interstitial lung disease as their primary presentation.
It's interesting that there's a smaller number of these patients who get acute exacerbation, people with connective tissue disease and ILD, than UIP, which seems to be a lot more prevalent.
I think it's because we leave patients on therapy, at least some anti-inflammatory therapy, longitudinally in this disease. So even though we might institute methotrexate or Imuran, azathioprine on top of prednisone, we'll typically keep a small dose of prednisone on going and push our other drugs, avoiding toxicity. And what that does, I think, is that it knocks down your baseline systemic inflammation so that you don't have as many acute exacerbations, unless they're infectious exacerbations. Mm-hmm. So one important point in this group of people, if you're going to be using immunomodulatory therapy, is really to watch very carefully for infections.
Okay, absolutely. You bring up a point that it's interesting. Two things. I wanted to talk about the length of therapy and how long do you do steroids before you add the immunosuppressive if you're not going to do it jointly. And the other thing is prophylaxis against some of the infection agents that we know can afflict these patients. PCP prophylaxis, for instance, in these patients. And do you do it or don't you? And do you monitor their CD4 counts and CD8 counts before you institute prophylaxis? Let me ask you both.
You're asking a lot of questions.
Yes.
One. No, I usually give them prednisone and azathioprine concomitantly. Mm-hmm. There's been no randomized controlled trials how long you treat patients with NSIP, for example. And so you just use your clinical judgment, and sometimes after a year, the patient's stable, I will try to taper the prednisone dose down as low as possible. But they do tend, if they recur, in my experience, they usually can control it with a second treatment.
I think there's another part to adequate control, at least in myositis, which is actually measuring both the CPK and aldolase values, because if you control muscle disease underneath this, if they're elevated at the beginning, then you have a little bit better handle on whether you've got the presumption of inflamed lung disease also being treated by that same regimen. And so I think that piece means that I want to get my muscle antibody levels back to normal, and then I'm looking for 6 to 12 months of adequate immune suppression before tempting the withdrawal. As we all know, in most of our connective tissue disease associated interstitial lung disease, these diseases are destined to return most of the time. And so I have a very low threshold to reinstitute therapy again.
And again, before you send them to transplant?
Well, it's very few of these people that make it to transplant. NSIP has a very much better survival than usual interstitial pneumonitis. And so, and there are also other features that make this group of individuals be less amenable to transplantation, such as their esophageal disease.
Yes.
So it's not that we won't send an occasional scleroderma patient for transplant if they have very limited disease to their lungs. But many of them don't qualify for transplant or have, in the case of rheumatoids, such severe articular disease or other limitations to quality of life that they really don't become a very good transplant candidate.
Mm-hmm. I think in those who are well screened, the results have shown that their outcome has been as good as in the idiopathic kind, so that we ought to keep it in the back of our minds at all times.
This is the second of three discussions for Pilot Peer-to-Peer Dialogue number 3. We would like to thank Drs. Padilla, San, and Strange for their contributions and continued support. Thank you for listening. To receive credit, please complete the attestation evaluation form.